Blog Talk Radio.
And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006. This is the author of the book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, reading from my book from Chapter 5 entitled Education for Living. Booker T. Washington presented a very viable program for the African Americans' development as a nation within a nation. A nation within a nation. He commented in an address presented during his tenure as president of the Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute that the educational leader must understand and appreciate the necessity for the races learning the difference between being worked as in slavery and doing for self. Booker T. Washington continued by explaining that the wise leader would not confine the Negro to industrial life, but believes that the very best service which anyone can render to what is called the higher education is to teach the present generation to work and save. This will create the wealth from which alone can come leisure and the opportunity for higher education. One of the most fundamental and far-reaching deeds that has been accomplished during the last quarter of a century has been that by which the Negro has been helped to find himself, to reacquire the knowledge of self, and to learn the secrets of civilization, to learn that there are a few simple cardinal principles upon which a race must start its upward course unless it would fail, and its last estate be worse than its first. It has been necessary for the Negro to learn the difference from being worked and working, to learn that being worked meant degradation while working for self means civilization, and that all forms of labor are honorable and all forms of idleness disgraceful. It has been necessary for him to learn and for her to learn that all races that have gotten upon their feet have done so largely by lean and economic foundation, and in general by beginning in a proper understanding of the need for civilization and ownership of the soil. Booker T. Washington said that 40 years ago, he's speaking back in the early 1900s, 40 years ago, my race emerged from slavery into freedom. If in too many cases the Negro race began development at the wrong end, it was largely because neither white nor black properly understood the case. Nor is it any wonder that this is so, for never before in the history of the world had such a problem been presented as that of the two races at the coming of freedom in this country. He said that for 250 years, I believe the way for the redemption of the Negro was being prepared through industrial development. Through all those years, the Southern white man did business with the Negro in a way that no one else has done business with him. In most cases, if a Southern white man wanted a house built, he consulted a Negro mechanic or engineer about the plan, or architect about the plan and about the actual building of the structure. If he wanted a suit of clothes made, he went to a Negro tailor, and for shoes, he went to a shoemaker of the same race. In a certain way, every slave plantation in the South was an industrial school. On these plantations, young colored men and women were constantly being trained not only as farmers, but as carpenters, blacksmiths, wheelwrights, brick masons, engineers, cooks, laundresses, sewing women, and housekeepers. Booker T. Washington continues saying, I do not mean in any way to apologize for the curse of slavery, which was a curse to both races, but in what I say about industrial training in slavery, I am simply stating facts. This training was crude and was given for selfish purposes. It did not answer the highest ends because there was an absence of mental training in connection with the training of the hands. To a large degree, though, this business contact with the Southern white man and the industrial training on the plantations left the Negro at the close of the war in possession of nearly all the common and skilled labor in the South. The industries that gave the South its power, prominence, and wealth prior to the Civil War, were mainly the raising of cotton, sugar cane, rice, and tobacco. Before the way could be prepared for the proper growing and marketing of these crops, forests had to be cleared, houses had to be built, public roads and railroads constructed. In all these works, the Negro did most of the heavy work. in the planting, cultivating, and marketing of the crops. Not only was the Negro the chief dependence, but in the manufacture of tobacco, he became a skilled and proficient workman. And in this, up to the present time in the South, he holds the lead in the large tobacco factories. In most of the industries, though, what happened? For nearly 20 years after the Civil War, except in a few instances, the value of the industrial training given by the plantations was overlooked. Negro men and women were educated in literature, in mathematics, and in the sciences, with little thought of what had been taking place during the preceding 250 years, except perhaps as something to be escaped, to be gotten away from as far as possible. As a generation began to pass, those who had been trained as mechanics and architects and engineers in slavery began to disappear by death, and gradually it began to be realized that there were few to take their places. There were young men educated in foreign tongues, in Greek and Latin and French, but few in carpentry or in mechanical or architectural drawing. Many were trained in Latin, but few as engineers and blacksmiths. Too many were taken from the farm and educated, but they were educated in everything but farming. For this reason, they had no interest in farming, and they did not return to it. And yet, 85% of the Negro population of the southern states, at that time anyway, lived, and for a considerable time, Booker T. Washington expected that they would continue to live in the country districts. And he continues, the charge is often brought against the...
We want to welcome all that have joined us for the Saturday evening program, Booker T. Washington Speaks, African American Family Room Forum. We thank you for participating tonight, those of you who are calling in to participate, and we also want to thank those of you who are just listening via the Internet. And if you decide that you would like to call in and participate, the guest call-in number is 657-383-0671. I'll repeat that in just a minute to give you an opportunity to get something to write it down with. But I am Marshall Washington Cabinet-Sibui, your host and moderator. I'm also the senior great-grandson of the Honorable Dr. Booker T. Washington, the famous educator of the early 20th century and late 19th century, who is credited with the founding of the Tuskegee Institute, which now is called Tuskegee University in Alabama. And we're certainly interested in discussing topics every week that pertain to things that the African-American community should have a conversation about. And one of the things that is happening now, it's happening with children of all nationalities, not so much is reported in the news about African-American children taking up firearms and going into schools to murder other children. However, there's an increasing trend of young people of various backgrounds beginning to do this. And so our question tonight is, do you see a correlation between behavior modification drugs such as, but not restricted to, Ritalin and Adderall and the homicidal attacks in schools by school-aged children? Now, I will mention that I did look at a report from one study, and this study said that there has been no correlation established, but this is just one study. I'm still investigating it because I do know for a fact that this violence by young people against other school teachers and maintenance people as well and school children sort of creeped in around the same time that school officials began to encourage parents to have their young children that had disruptive behaviors put on these drugs. So So even though this one article said that out of 48 reported incidents of young people in the schools attacking others, the number of those 48 that were actually on Ritalin was probably less than 1 out of 5. So that would not definitely establish a real correlation with that one study. But I'm convinced personally that when you start altering the chemistry for whatever reason of a child, you can expect over a period of time that there are going to be problems. There may not be psychotic problems that result in homicides, but I do believe that you will have problems. And I'll close my little opening statement by saying this. You know, when I came up back in the 1940s and 1950s as a child and as a young teenager, we didn't have those drugs prescribed to us. I don't know a single person that was in school with me, including myself and my family members. I had a brother and a sister, that any teacher or school counselor said needed to be put on drugs because of some behavior issues. I know for a fact that I was hyperactive. I probably today would be one that would be given the label of ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity. But that was only because of the fact that my mind was very active, because my parents encouraged me to do a lot of reading. And as a result, I was always ahead of my class, maybe not everyone, but most of the people in my class, because they put a lot of emphasis on me doing very well in school. So when I went to class, I had the answers that some students did not have, and I did seek attention. And so I would be maybe a little disruptive, waving my hand and getting really hyper. And I'm sure that today, if I were a 7 or 8 year old child, the teachers might have said that I need to be on some of these drugs. But I turned out to be a person that did not need that, because the structure of the society at that time basically kept all of the children in check. And we didn't have any situations of any children bringing guns to class to bring havoc and mayhem and murder people. I'm just wondering. So anyway, we want to welcome Mr. Bianchi, one of our regular panelists. In fact, Ms. Bianchi, you actually, along with two or three other people, the mainstays of this African-American Family Room Forum. And we always welcome your comments. So you've heard the topic in my little discussion. But good evening, welcome, and hopefully you're getting into a nice mood for the holiday season. Some people don't make a big deal out of the holidays, but it is a special time. And so I see that Mr. Bianchi just dropped off, and until somebody else comes on, we're just going to go ahead and continue to play. No, he's back on now. So good. Ms. Bianchi, welcome to the show, and you've heard the topic. What do you think about that?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I had actually had the volume turned down on my education
and industrial development. Yeah, it is, and something's running in the background.
Factories, farms, service occupations for the Negro, not because I want to free him, but because I want to free him.
You must have your computer on Blog Talk, and it's playing while you talking on your speakerphone. I can't hear nothing now. Yeah, we can't hear you, Marshall. Where you go?
Okay, I see. It's a little technical problem. There was a button that I needed to push to turn my mic on, and I just noticed.
Yeah, that's better.
Yeah, we are now. I think everything should be fine.
So, what was your topic again?
Okay. Yeah, let me repeat the topic. And I see that Sister Vaina just joined us, and she's a teacher and worked with young people for many years. And so she may want to weigh in on this. But here's the topic. Do you see a correlation between behavior modification drugs, such as, but not restricted to, Ritalin and Adderall, and the homicidal attacks in schools by school-age children? So that is the topic.
Me, myself, I couldn't speak on that because I don't know any kids, any children directly that's on that type of activity. The only thing I can comment by is what general population, general conversations, and the way they go.
Okay. And mm-hmm. I understand that. And actually, I haven't had any real direct experience myself with children. I raised two young children, but they weren't on any type of psychiatric or behavior modification drugs. I do know of some families that have their children on drugs, but they did not turn out to be the kind of kids that were attacking others. As far as I know, they didn't exhibit that type of extreme psychotic behavior. But as I was saying earlier, it just seems that since these drugs began to be introduced as a way of trying to pacify the natural hyperactivity of a lot of the children around that same time, that these drugs became commonplace and prevalent in the schools. It seems that around that same time, that's when a lot of this violence of children attacking the teachers and attacking children in the schools began to happen. And so I'm just wondering if anybody has any opinion about it. Let's just ask Sister Vaina, do you have any opinion about that?
Good evening, everybody. I'm not for children being on drugs at all. I had a young child. His mother had him on Ritalin at the age of 5. And I told her he was too young to be on that kind of medication, that something else was going on. But to make a long story short, what eventually happened, when he got to middle school, he almost died because what happened, the child was having silent seizures. But when he had the seizure, he would act violently. And it didn't have anything to do with his behavior. He had something physically wrong with him. And then when he got to middle school, he almost died in the took him to the hospital. He stayed overnight, and that's when they discovered he was having silent seizures and were able to put him on the right type of medication for those seizures. So we don't really know what's going on with young people and to just put them on drugs. But a lot of parents, young parents especially, they get some kind of financial reward, if you want to say that, for allowing them to put their children on these drugs. It's a big check for them, everyone. I don't agree with anybody intoxicating or altering someone's behavior with drugs like that, because something else could be going on in their brain, and we didn't even know. It's just in the case of this young person that I'm telling you about right now. And what would happen when he had a seizure, he would become violent towards all the other children. And who knows why that was happening, but that was, that's what the problem was. It wasn't that he had a behavior disorder. He was physically ill. Okay, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Sister Baena. Thank you very much. And we've been joined by another participant, and we certainly want to hear your opinion, but I will repeat the topic just to make sure that it's understood. And the topic is, do you see a correlation between behavior modification drugs, such as but not restricted to Ritalin and Adderall, and the homicidal attacks in schools by school-age children? And we can modify that to include not just homicidal attacks, but other violent activity by school-age children. Do you see any correlation between these behavior-modifying drugs and the students becoming more and more violent? Seems like over the last decade or two, a lot of young children have acted out violent dramas in school, including taking weapons and killing people. But it seems like this has almost paralleled the commonplace prescription of these drugs. So do you see any correlation? So we do have several people on the line, and we want to ask anyone who wants to chime in to go ahead. But we definitely want to invite our caller who just joined us from the 313 area code. And I know that we've talked many times, had some very, very interesting and thought-provoking conversations. So I'd like to hear your opinion. And if you want to introduce yourself, we certainly would like to entertain that. If you want me to introduce you, I'd be happy to do it. But our friend from Detroit, would you like to weigh in on that topic?
Thank you, my brother. I'm not fully acquainted with the topic to the point where I feel like I have enough statistical information in order to weigh in on the topic. So I will defer at this point. Thank you, though.
Okay. Well, that's fine. And to be honest with you, it's not a topic that I've been able to find studies that are conclusive. I found one study in my research where it said that 48 cases of this psychotic dangerous behavior had been studied, and only about 20%, I think 18% actually, of the children that were in this case study of being homicidally violent young people were actually on the drugs. But, you know, that study was only done by a couple of people, and so it's not really definitive enough to be able to say that that is a real correlation. And so what I'm actually proposing is that we can generally talk about, if not from a statistical point of view, but from what we would call a common knowledge point of view, what is happening to these children, even if it doesn't result in a statistically accurate assumption or correlation that they're being pushed into getting violent by these drugs. But what is happening to these children as far as common knowledge is concerned? Does anyone want to comment on that? You know, it's interesting. I don't want to take up all the time, and we don't have to have a long conversation, and we don't have to stick to this particular topic either. One of the guidelines that we established almost a year and a half ago near the beginning of the show was that if I choose the topic, and I choose the topic every week, generally based on what's going on in the news, and just because of what happened here this past week where this 14-year-old went to school with a firearm and someone tipped off the officials, it may have been his mother, but whoever it was saved probably the lives of several people, because this child apparently was going there to do some harm to people. And that's what prompted me to, and I don't believe it was an African-American child, but that's what prompted me to want to talk about this issue, because we see it now almost on a monthly basis. Some child is going into the schools armed and beginning to kill people. But we don't have to talk about that. I just wanted to see if anyone had any opinion about these drugs being propagated for people to try to control the children. So if you want to talk about that general topic, Brother Minister, or Sister Aina, Ms. Bianca, that's fine. Or we could shift to another more interesting topic to keep the discussion going.
No, I can chime in on it from a, and, but I don't, my chiming in, I don't want to be, I say, restrained or to say specifically that it this is that this has something to do with drug, something that's drug induced. I'm more inclined to believe that there's some psychological issues that underlying, based on the statistics I am familiar with, I am the grandson of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali. I am a published author. My wife, I was married to, she happened to be of the Jehovah's Witness faith, but Lord be pleased with her. She passed in 2002, but I will, and as it applies to her, I came to be acquainted with quite a few statistics because she had her degree from Roosevelt University in psychology, and by virtue of which she happened to have had 140 children under her guardianship through the Department of Children and Family Services. So there were quite a few statistics that I became acutely aware of as a result of marriage. And I became, whatever she was involved in, I always found, we had to, develop a common sense of discussion. So I would say this is that the, as the grandson of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, too, I'll say this, that my grandfather's mentor and teacher, Master Fuad Muhammad, Saudi-born, Arabian-born, because he was born before the Saudi government was established, 1877. Any case, but he was known. That's where Muhammad was known to be a pretty good pronosticator. In other words, he could. He made a prediction, or you can pretty much be certain that whatever he said would come to pass. And one of the things he said was relative to the topic which we're on now. Was he said that the colleges were going to start turning out the society because of the country, the creed of this country, and the college students, analyzing or putting logic to this, to the behavior of the country in many ways, then they would become disenchanted. That prediction was back in the 30s. So we've seen many stages of metamorphosis in terms of the changes this country has underwent. It's called Cleveland Stovall. I think he was one of the first mass murderers on a college campus. That was at Northwestern University more than 10 years ago. And I know that you mentioned this incident most recently with this young child but you also chimed in to say you don't think the child was African American. So that index of evaluation when it comes to whether or not the child was African American or was not of African American, that seemed to have weighed in quite heavily too, because it seems like these college campus massacres have been predominantly, just like the one down in earlier this year in the Carolinas. You know, it seemed like these incidents occur more frequently in Caucasian families. You know, they, and oftentimes it appears that they'll have something, I don't know if it has something to do with the fact that they are oftentimes exposed to using firearms more so than African-American children, or maybe exposed to using firearms. They're taught and to be, you know, and taken out, you know, on hunting trips and things like that. But, you know, it's a very serious problem. You speak of just looking at it from a logic. What I've learned from some of my grandchildren who are in their 20s is that, like in Chicago, I think they have one of the highest murder rates in the country, like 764 last year. I'm not sure what the statistic is now. Handgun violence murders. Even ER, they said, which was filmed in Chicago because they have such a high murder rate there. I'm originally a native of Chicago. My granddaughter was telling me that one of the things affecting their attitudes is, they say, like when older people get on the bus, they are able to get on the bus, you know, at a discounted fare, senior citizen fare. So the young children are being told that they are actually footing the bill for the courtesy being extended to older people, and they have developed a resentment for that. You know, the whole concept also, we are the world. You know, it's almost like a hourglass has been turned upside down based on, you know, the cultural value system under which I grew up, respecting our elders as having laid the foundation for us, and therefore we respect them. But nowadays, seems like the children it's being cultivated in the minds of the children or young people that they are the future, so therefore being extolled or placed above the parent or the grandparent, you know. And this is a total reverse psychology from which I was raised under when it comes to respecting those who have made a way for you, you know, and in this particular mindset, seems cancerous impacts. From what I can see is that the lack of respect is given when respect is earned, it's not just given. So they not haven't been here long enough to earn the respect, but then they also come into this world and have come into this world during a period of in this country where we have so many social programs where like in families with single parent families and the monetary benefits being given to the parents Children and Family Services, ADC, Aid to Dependent Children, Section 8, afforded the parent, because the child oftentimes becomes aware that their parents, single parents, might be receiving some benefit because of them, then they feel like that puts them in some kind of position of authority, this is certainly not a biblical precept because the Bible says spare the rod and spoil the child, so the perception cast from a biblical standpoint is the parent is the one who's in authority, advertised billions of dollars spent on advertising is oftentimes targeted to children because the children oftentimes in being placated, or the people who are marketing experts, they are aware of this. I mean, when it comes to Jordan gym shoes, Air Jordans, gym shoes, that costs $100, $200, outrageous. Perhaps in the context of the income of the family, but the child becomes so irate or unmanageable because there's a peer pressure that they have to have a pair of Air Jordans. And this dysfunctional mindset is witnessed also with cell phones. If the child can't have a cell phone, it becomes, almost to the point where they become, totally unmanageable, unreasonable, okay? And you can't even reason with them. I've seen this happen in a number of occasions in various situations. When I was when I came up, there was no such thing as you're going to get your parent to kowtow to your outrage or acting out or temper tantrums. You can have a temper tantrum as long as you want to. Your parents, that was not what I was brought up. So I think a lot of, and for but from based on the topic relative to drugs being introduced as a way by which to modify some of these behavioral issues, you know, I certainly can and be inclined to believe. I know down in Mexico, because I lived in Mexico for a couple of years, the parents, in fact, have given a hypodermic, you know what I mean, with sedatives, you know, for children, you know. But, you know, in Mexico, the social and cultural makeup is much different from the African American community and even the Caucasian community. From what I know of the Caucasian community, you know, in Mexico, you know, they refer to the child, my prince or my princess, you know. They raise their children to have with high esteem, you know. Whereas, you know, one of the major pitfalls, you know, in many African American families, you know, especially when they're then become dysfunctional to the point where there's only one parent, you know, oftentimes much of the discontent that led to the parent, oftentimes, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's the mother raising the child by herself, you know, is oftentimes levels of bitterness that that the child becomes saddled with because of the discontent, you know, that she feels toward the father of the child, and oftentimes feeling abandoned or something of that nature. But anyway, that's enough. You know, I think I've shared much of my sentiments on that topic. So if you want to go ahead, anyone else want to chime in from that standpoint?
Okay, thank you, Brother Minister. And for those who just joined us, before we go any further, I just want to reintroduce or reacquaint those of you who may not be familiar with our speaker. He is Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali, the grandson of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the late leader of the Nation of Islam. And so he has been a participant in this panel on a number of occasions. So if you have any questions for him specific to his background or anything he may want to talk about, I would hope that you would just be comfortable asking him, and then he could choose whether or not he wants to talk about it. But anyway, for you who have just joined us, and I see we have a new participant, the topic that we started off with is, do you see a correlation between behavior modification drugs such as, but not restricted to, Ritalin and Adderall and the homicidal attacks in schools by school-aged children? We kind of modified that topic once we got into it to expand it to indicate that, what is your opinion about these modification drugs being given to children? So we do have a couple of other people that have joined us. So anybody at this point, if you want to chime in, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
I'll make one further comment, since unless anyone else can, please feel free to chime in. But I'll make one other comment first. You know, since I've been formally introduced, one of these springboard catalysts for my grandfather's original debut of in this country was the fact that his name was Elijah, that name is referenced in the last chapter of the Old Testament, under Malachi, they say, "Behold, I shall send unto you Elijah, who shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers." So this whole subject revolves around, you know, the family structure and the relationship between parent and child, and how even biblically, and then the chapter goes on further to say that, you know, if, you know, he said, "Lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." This really speaks to the relationship between, you know, the father and the son, the children and their parents, you know, and the breakdown in the social and cultural breakdown in regard to this, you know, very crucial fabric, part of the social and cultural fabric of, which is the family unit itself, in the relationship between the children and the parents. You know, these cell phones too, you know, I feel, you know, are a serious component, social component in much of what we see here, because you have these social media platforms like Facebook, and seem like if you watch them, or either note other people who watch those, who are constantly caught up in cyberspace, rather than, you know, cultivating and developing one-on-one relationships with people who are sitting right next to them, or within, you know, the art of conversation has been seriously adversely impacted, you know, with these, because everybody wants, it seems like, if you, you know, these cell phones, they feel like the whole world is watching them, and they have, 10 seconds of fame, and it seems like they almost become competitive when it comes to who can be the most outrageous, you know what I mean? These cell phones, you know, the role that they are playing, and this has been in that massacre down in the Carolinas. One of the psychologists brought this up too, because, you know, see, just like before a soldier goes to battle, oftentimes, you know, he's conditioned, you know, almost like in a penny arcade like situation to, you know, to respond, you know, without emotion. But these cell phones, you know, and then many of these children are being raised, you know, by being set in front of a television, and the television is programming. So there seems to be a disconnect, you know, a very serious disconnect, you know, by virtue of this cyberspace, these televisions and media, you know, presentations, rather than the one-on-one, just like our parents, you know, I spoke to a young guy in a hardware, and he, you know, I'm a published author too, which, you know, I became a published author about 16 years ago, 15, you know, 16 years now, November of 2002, the book came out, you know, The Evolution of the Nation of Islam. And so in this hardware, the young man who was behind the counter, he's in his 20s, you know, he knew that many of those who worked in hardware had been privy to my book, had read it. And so he could simply come weighed in one time. I was, you know, making a purchase to tell me that, you know, their generation is referred to as being a lost generation. I told him, what is the word human means the ability to empathize with other people. I say, we were raised by our parents and grandparents. Y'all, most of the time, sat in front of a television, okay, or either become caught up in these cyberspace adventures, you know. And so there's a very serious disconnect component there, okay, when it comes to empathy. And, you know, and just like over the telephone, oftentimes what you will say to someone over the telephone and what you will say to someone who's looking you right in the face may be a huge difference by as to what you will say if you're actually sitting there listening, you know, face to face with someone. You know what I mean? That, you know, the empathy or lack thereof, of being empathetic or sensitive, you know what I mean? And this, you know, and there's another component here too, and I know that this is a component that many people may have various opinions about, and that's when it comes to it's called GBL, gay, lesbian, and bisexual. You know, this whole movement, or when it comes to that movement, that's another very socially, what I consider to be socially destructive element in terms of it being that behavior or that, choice being, considered to be normal or common. You know, that's been going on since thousands of years. You know what I mean? There's statues you can see in India with all these, you know, even in Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, those kinds of things, and that, but they want to call it new school, but there's nothing new about it, okay? But one of the things is these people going on their jobs and just killing people on their jobs. I mean, this kind of social, conduct going into churches, you know, going into synagogues, just murdering people. You know what I mean? This there's a very, very serious, human element disconnect here. You know, when you have this kind of behavior afoot, okay, it's really a social and cultural crisis, really, I would say. You know, they want to try to say something about, you know, Islam terrorists, but, you know, I mean, when the Oklahoma bombing, you know, this big guy, Timothy McVeigh, he's featured in my book, as a matter of fact, you know, when it comes to what's called white backlash, you know, his discontent had to do with, you know, black inclusion in government. You know, he felt like that was some kind of betrayal of Caucasian people, because this country was, you know, was, as far as his view, founded, you know, for white people. And they talk about how he had killed so many children who were a daycare center in that building. You know, his callous sense of insensitive disregard was to the point where he referred to them as collateral damage. In other words, I wasn't trying to kill the kids, but if that's what their destiny was, then so be it. I mean, he was that, and he actually, when they found him guilty, he requested to be killed, he said, because he considered himself to be a soldier. So, I mean, anytime people are so, indoctrinated, I mean, his man, what he used in order to blow the building up is things that were put together that a farmer would have on a farm, but he had books to tell him how to mix these different chemicals that are generally used for farming in order to create an explosion that took the whole face of that building off. I mean, the Oklahoma bombing is still, you know, iconic when you go to the internet and look it up and see just how, you know, ugly it was, you know, of a black eye, you know, that this country has gotten, you know, when it comes to homegrown terrorism. You know, that's what, that's how they label it. You know what I mean? But, and, you know, anyway, so it's, some people even want to say that the fact that the our president, and who came to office, you know, through Facebook and other social media platforms, because he called mainstream media as being fake news. But he, one of the things, he came to office with, four months prior, he was on his Facebook, he is posing with a cross burning in the background with two Ku Klux Klan under each arm. I mean, it's, you know, I'm just saying, I mean, that doesn't sound like a guy who is very empathetic and, you know, to the black community, you know, when with such a history that is associated with the Klan. You know, when it comes to black people, I mean, you have Emmett Till. I mean, I don't know how many people in my age group, maybe they might know about Emmett Till, which was one of the, you know, he was accused of having whistled at a white girl, and then they found him, you know, brutally murdered in a swamp, like, you know, with barbed wire and all this. You know, his mother brought him to up to Chicago, where he's buried and everything. But anyway, and then, you know, to call attention to the kind of behavior that black people so frequently face with in the South, and you know, so I mean, I'm just saying, for a president to come to office, you know, with that kind of those kind of symbols, you know, and then coming to office right behind a black man having been elected, you know, and the first African American first lady. I mean, obviously he was making an appeal to white backlash, you know, because statistically I'm also informed that the birth rate among Caucasians in this country is less than zero. So it's rally around the flag, boys, because, you know, what do you call gentrification or browning of America? This issue is, there's a level of aggression being brought to bear culturally, you know, as it relates to that. And the country seems like it's being divided on this issue. I mean, you have, you know, a number of talk shows.
Well, you know, every country goes through that thing there about the demographic changes, and I don't blame them. People have well-established traditions and norms, and they try to maintain them. No matter what country, I would say that you go to. But you know, on the other hand, you know, there's a lot of good things that's going on. Marshall today at the scheduled National Society of Black Engineers Saturday sessions, I had an opportunity to work with some young men in a classroom, and they built bridges with popsicle sticks. And I worked with two of them and explained to them the principles behind it. And the once they learned the principles, and one of them was pretty smart, questions that I asked, and he built his it was a box bridge, and it was about four or five other groups in the class, and took his box bridge and time come to load them up with some heavy weights, concrete blocks and cylinders and concrete, and his bridge and the other young man's bridge, they're the only ones that could hold the total weight that was being applied. So they was very happy over that. And we had students that participated in other workshops, from blueprint reading to robotics, mathematics, and so on and so on. It's just something that goes on every third Saturday in the month. Next big schedule thing would be the national convention, where you probably have 15 to 20,000 young black youth that's participating in STEM programs, plus M, which is mathematics. And they would have an opportunity to, those that's at that level would have an opportunity to be hired right off the floor by businesses. And the top 50, you have the FBI and the CIA that's hiring young African-American black kids that have STEM background.
Can I weigh in on that? You know, I work with my son. Anyway, he was in high school. I worked with him on a similar project. He had building a bridge out of popsicle sticks, just as you mentioned. But, you know, you were saying every country goes through this. You know, in terms of the promise when it comes, see, we're some of the most resilient people probably ever on the planet. You know, because when the Southerners went down and they saw us on the plantation, talking about jambalaya, coffee's pie, fillet gumbo, they say, don't they know they're slaves? See, we are very, very resilient, brother. And see, right now, just like President Obama's children, they were studying, I think, Mandarin, Chinese, because China, about 15 years ago, you know, there's a black man who went over representing Chrysler. To open up the factories in China, because they had pulled him out of one of the universities. He was a nuclear physicist, black man was, and so they hired him to go over there and open up their facility for them, because the Chinese say these Europeans in their nomenclature, they have an arrogance that they can't get out. So, you know, like I spent quite a bit of time.
Well, it's not all Europeans that think that. If it wasn't for Europeans, the British, China wouldn't have any railroads, which is a major part of their society. Not only them, but other India groups too. If it wasn't for American railroad builders, Peru, Ecuador, South America wouldn't have.
Yeah, well, so you're kind of missing the point. They're saying that there's something about in their nomenclature, they have an arrogance. In other words, you know, they will submit only if their submission is going to allow them to go to the point where they're going to be able to run things and dictate. So I'm not challenging their creativity. Okay. I'm not speaking to that. I'm only saying the reason why China say don't send any more them over here, because we're not going to teach them the language and we're not going to teach them the culture. But by virtue of China taking that position, and right now most of a great part of America's labor force has been exported to China, but that only means that as far as we are concerned, or African Americans are concerned, and when it comes to the genius of blacks, or people, period, I was spent a couple of years in Louisiana just last year. I came back earlier this year, here to Detroit, where Islam first got its start. But in any case, I would point out to them, I say it was a black man, whose slave master happened to be an engineer who invented the cotton gin. And when cotton became king, you know, from the Southerners exporting cotton overseas, and they exchanged it for gold. When they got enough gold in it, then the South decided to print, start printing their own money, and in order to preserve the Union, that's the reason, you know, the industrialized North, you know, that's
well, you know,
preserved the
Union. You know, all ethnic groups contribute. Look how the Chinese contribute to building the railroads. That when Lincoln wanted to have a transcontinental railroad
Yes, I have everything you're saying. I totally embrace, and you're 100% correct.
Yeah. So human beings contribute to the well-being of a human society all the time, and has always been there. A lot goes on that you don't hear about. The loom to weave silk that was created by, you know, people there in Turkey and Pakistan. So human beings across the world have contributed to the things that make life better for all human beings in particular, not just blacks, not just Chinese, human beings, period.
Anyway, I know that we were taught, and statistically they say that people of color outnumber Caucasians 11 to 1 all over the planet. I mean, there's a billion people in China, another billion in India, and they don't consider themselves Caucasian, you know, not even to talk about the hundreds of millions.
Yeah, but if you took any one particular group, that's their particular group. You got Eskimos, who's dark complexion. You got Indians, who consider themselves as Caucasians. So that's a particular group. And just because your skin is of a certain kind, a certain type, that don't mean you are of a certain kind. Skin color does not equate to any allegiance on the planet other than your particular group.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm only saying that the planet is not dominated by Europeans.
Planet is not dominated by African people from Africa neither.
No, I'm not suggesting that either, you know, because I concede that without question. Okay.
The planet is not dominated by people from Ecuador. Planet is not dominated by Chinese. There's many different ethnic groups of different phenotypical features that make up the human population on the planet.
You know, in the Holy Quran, you know, we're going to go back to a book, you know, from which Muslims, draw a lot of, you know, our insights and base a lot of our opinion. One of the things say that God created us, Allah created us as nations and tribes, okay, that we would know each other. And so that speaks to something you just mentioned, is that it's not, say, an individual, it's a collective presence. And matter of fact, there's a lot of things.
You got to remember, that all ethnic groups had their own God, and their religion was nothing other than a deification of their culture. That's why you find so many things pertaining to what usually come out of culture: who you should marry, who you shouldn't marry, what you should eat, what you shouldn't eat, what days are for celebratory observation, and so on and so on and so on. So the last religion, which I guess was the Western religion, would be Islam, would have had to copy and take pointers off of what preceded it. All people don't believe that, which they have a right not to.
That's 100% correct. As a matter of fact, you know, the religion like Islam. Since I've been a published author, I've been interviewed on various programs, but my book also speaks to an understanding on this level, and that is that, you know, Islam embraces all of the prophets of Judaism, embraces the Christ as the Christ, you know, so like what you're leading to is and alluding to is absolutely correct, okay, and the word Allah refers. It's not, It's just a reference name. It means it refers to God's 99 of God's attributes. Like when the Holy Prophet Moses, he went to God and asked, you know, what is your name? He says that I am that I am. They gave a name to
and,
that.
Yeah, in ancient Kemet, it was Nuk Puk Nuk. The same meaning. And for Islam to brace all the prophets means that Islam braced some of the mythical characters that never existed in human form. But that's all right if that's what they want to do.
Well, see, you know, got to understand. Well, you say, you know, this is a book of healing, okay, spiritual healing. So man is a spiritual creature. So then, you know, so therefore, if you're going to be speaking or talking on that plane, then you don't necessarily have to be speaking to an embodied spirit in that context. I mm-hmm. think that's what we're
and
going.
Life itself has a sense of spirit. We have four elephants here in the St. Louis Zoo. No, at Bush's wildlife. And two died, and the last two was grieving, so that one of them died just here the other day. So that leaves one. So animals, whether they're ants, mosquitoes, or elephants, or tigers, they share that same sort of things that we like to attribute to being spiritual.
No, see, that's what I mentioned earlier. I say human means an ability to empathize with others, but what you're calling attention to is the level of empathy that even exists, you know, among animals, okay? And man has to, you know, man is the highest
actually,
form
man
of
is a form of animals. He's a mammal.
That's what I say.
The female has breasts that they feed milk to the babies and so on and so on. So...
We can't divorce ourselves from the fact that yes, man is an animal. One of the things they say, you know, like in theology school, you know, they say that man, one of the things that differentiates man from other animals is that man develops his own environment, whereas other creatures have to adapt to their environment. Man creates his own environment. Okay, this is one of
man also adapts to other environments too. You know, the people that left warm climates and went into colder climates, they had to adapt to those climates. They just didn't go there and all of a sudden just everything is cool with them.
No,
blacks that's in the here in this part of the Western Hemisphere, they are adapting to you. If you just look at the child. The next generation of child, they're losing more and more pigmentation. So what they're doing, they are adapting to the environment that they live in. If you put them in England, they're going to lose more and more pigmentation because they don't need it there. There's no need to have that dark pigmentation that you would need if you lived on the equator.
That has a lot to do with melanin, but you know, just like the Eskimo, you know, Eskimo, even the name Eskimo means flesh eater. But you know, the Eskimo, he builds an igloo. What I'm saying, he establishes an environment that is conducive to, you know, to his habitation. So that is the point I was calling attention to. I'm not.
Yeah, Eskimos build igloos because there's no forest where they can cut down wood.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, yes.
So they had to adapt.
Exactly. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
You go into somebody else's household, you're going to adapt to their rules and regulations.
Well, this that now what you're saying there is something that my grandfather used. What he would say oftentimes from the rostrum. May God be pleasing him. He said that we have to remember we're in another man's house. Okay? See, we don't have no 6th fleet, and we don't have no 7th fleet, 1,400 ships and several nuclear submarines. So I'm just saying, you know, the house we live in, you know, and the culture has been established here, you know, black people can't lay claim to it. We were actually brought over here, you know, some people say sold, but yeah, I'm not saying we weren't sold into slavery, but it certainly wasn't. This is a brand new form of slavery, you know, never before. Witness when anytime we sleep in our own urination of defecation, and then and our grandmother strapped to a bedpost and taken like a horse in a stall to bastardize us as the people. You know, Britain, they colonialized, but they were never culturally, you know, debased.
Well, you know, I had to beg to differ with someone say that the blacks in America don't have a sixth or fifth fleet. That's not true. They're United States citizens. And that military is there for their behalf.
Yeah.
Now, those who don't think they are, it's perfectly fine that they don't. And that's where they want to live. But technically,
Let me finish.
Technically, if you go someplace else, if you get on an airplane to travel someplace, you're going to have to show that United States passport. When you land where you land and get ready to go through customs, you have to show that U.S. passport, unless you're a dual citizen, and that passport has a visa which permits you to go into that country. So now, for people to say the United States don't have an army, a navy, that's not true. I'm sorry, not the United States. Say that blacks, as if blacks is something separate. Blacks are not separate. Blacks are United States citizens.
I don't differ with you, and I certainly understand, you know, the gray area in which you speak. But I'm only, you know, I'm saying, yeah, my grandfather, on my mother's side, he served in the Philippines. Okay, the blood. I mean, 70% of us are actually are of the indigenous Native Americans, for that matter. So, I mean, and how much the price that we have paid, you know, and the contributions we have made to this country, you know, and it's in all of its greatness and all of its faults too. You know what I mean? As they may be.
Well, I don't say that 70% of what you call present-day African-American, black adjectives, are blacks, or 70% Native American. I guess you were saying that was held by the five civilized tribes. I wouldn't give that
If you do the genealogical chart, I know Warren Buffett did one, and he said that there's 70% of us are of European descent as well. That speaks to the Africans, many Africans who want to disown us as being a bastardized people, you know, and they became very aggressive with that stance when like, you know, they did a survey, college, they say, Michael Jordan. You know, they did a survey to find out how much money was being generated by his memorabilia, those gym shoes, you know, which cost $5 in China. With Nike. They were paying Michael 1% of $10 billion. $100 million is 1% of it. Of $10 billion, and they say anytime. So the Africans became very, you know, how you say, disgruntled, even with the Williams girls. They began to act out once they were, you know, been subjected to.
Well, I can't get into that man's finances. I really don't have no interest in it. I don't think he would put his finances out on the table.
No, I'm only saying
it's probably
saying
just
anything.
A bunch of hearsay.
Until you see his financials.
It's just hearsay.
He's a billionaire today, but I'm saying that the Africans have the African people have did somewhat. I've been to, you know, I don't know if you've spent any time in Africa, but anyway, they have got to the point they want to disown us because they feel that we're using the DNA, you know, just like Jesse Owens. I mean Joe Louis. I mean, he knocked out Smelling, you know, and Hitler walked out of the arena. I'm just saying, Black people have exemplified themselves in so many ways, but Africans want to claim us.
Let me ask you a question. You just use this word black. What is black people? What is black?
That question was asked me by one of my Egyptian partners. Okay, and you know,
just what is black?
No. Your question is well founded, brother. I'm not. Don't get the impression I'm going to try to walk away from the question. Okay. I told him the reason I use that language, it only speaks to our being empathetic to people of color. Okay. Because seems like, you know, just like Minister Malcolm, who I came, between the age of 5 and 15 years old, I was up under Minister Malcolm, and I was pleased with him, is that, you know, see, he said he made a point, I think he was debating up at Harvard, you know, Harvard University, he made a point that he said nobody is the color of a piece of paper in terms of white, but the fact that y'all, you know, here is these pink people, who want to claim to be white, okay? They're claiming this in a context of purity, and they want to be identified as being white, but they're not the color of a piece of paper.
Black?
What I'm trying to point out here is, see, just like when Dr. King came and spent time with my grandfather last year, when Dr. King was with us, God be pleased with him. You know, when you telling someone else, when the people who are over you have an opinion, they want to be called white, okay? So you asking them to accept you.
But my question is, what is black?
What I was pointing out to you is this, is there is no white people either.
Well, I'm not asking about white people.
Let's
pretend like what we call white don't even exist. But what in the world is black?
This conversation would not even be a point of discussion if it were not for Caucasians wanting to be called white. So then when you get into the conversation about black, then that's just the opposite to white in that context.
Yeah, but you still haven't told me what it is. What is black? What does a black person look? What are you calling a black person?
A person who is who
now, you know, Elijah Muhammad said that people were Asiatic black men. I don't understand, but let's leave that off the table.
Is
black?
Anyone who does not consider himself a Caucasian, okay? And you mentioned earlier that they get people from India and they got people Indians who want to be regarded as being Caucasian. You know, mulatto, you know, means Caucasian with melanin. So, and I know even over in Africa, like Minister Farrakhan, you know, he's fair complected, and his daughter is about my grandfather's color. So these are colors you can readily identify with. They are called by the Africans by the same name they refer to a white girl. Because they are, you know, because when you look at an African, some of them are might call blue black, okay? But naturally, Minister Farrakhan is a far cry from being that color.
Is the Farrakhan black?
That's my point. I'm saying the color line is at different places. It depends on what part of the world.
Yeah, but I'm asking you a question. You know, you seem like you're waltzing all around the answer. Is Minister Farrakhan black? Is Elijah Muhammad black? Is Wesley Snipes black? Is Isaac Hayes black?
According
is Lupita,
white,
the lady that won the Oscar, is she black? What is black?
Brother, I'm saying to you, my grandfather said the original man, you know, so that I identify myself as being an original man.
That's another point. What are they talking about an original man?
that's some, you know, well, not, well, what do they call an original man? That means
What did the original man look like?
A person who looks like the original inhabitants of the planet. Okay, because,
so what were these? What were these inhabitants? Were they humanoids? Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
They were humanoids.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay, now those humanoids was not fully developed as we are today. So how can we say that they was? You know, you wouldn't want to go to bed with one. It's confusing.
We were in a discussion.
And who was around to see them, the so-called original humans or the human people? Who was around to either paint a picture of them? And you surely wasn't photographing. So who was around then to verify this?
I'm not the one to be able to say, because I only know what someone told me. Just like most of the knowledge we come to acquire is based on something we learn.
Somebody telling us something is not accurate. What's your name, sir?
Jesus Muhammad Ali.
Sir, my name is Pianki. It's spelled P-I-A-N-K-I. Mr. Marshall, you still around?
Yes, I'm here. I'm enjoying the discussion.
All right. Well, I know it's getting kind of late. It's almost 8:30.
Yeah. Well, you know, I never cut off a discussion as long as the participants still want to talk.
I think I'm going to back off.
Well, I'm fine with whatever y'all want to do. You know, one of the reasons why I'll share this with you, I may have said it on the air before, but one of the reasons why I started this show and invited people to join the show is I love to hear our people have conversations. You know, something that just is very, very, it just helps me to enjoy my time, especially my Saturday evening, is to hear our people, yourself, Brother Minister Jesus, sisters that come on there, having a conversation. In my opinion, and there are people who may differ with me, but on this particular show, I'm not saying in the larger context, there are no right or wrong answers. I mean, if something is false, obviously, you know, somebody needs to be called out on that. If they say that, you know, a Amtrak railroad train was seen flying around the sun, then I would have to take issue with that because that's obviously not real. But if they have an opinion, like you asked Brother Minister Jesus about what is black, I'll be honest with you, I don't even know if I can answer that question except the way that he's approaching it, and that's anybody that's not a Caucasian. But I will share this with whoever may be interested in knowing it. You know, when I was in the Nation of Islam, I was going around telling everybody I'm a black man. Before that, you know, I didn't really make a big deal out of it. Somebody was calling me black. I would say, why you say that? Look at me. I'm not black. But then in the nation, then I was told that we were all black if we weren't Caucasian. But now, on my official record with the state of Georgia, I'm other. They give us opportunity to be what we want to be. And I ain't put on there black, and I didn't put on there white, because obviously I'm not a Caucasian. I might look close to being one, but a white man that knows the way to tell the difference, they would say, well, you know, you don't cut it. You know, you can't be a Caucasian. You might have a lot of Caucasian in you. So I say, well, I'm other, which includes the African, the French, the Scotch-Irish, the English, the Cherokee Indian, and maybe a few other things that I'm not even familiar with. So I just say I'm a other. If they want to try to break that down, they can run a DNA test on me, because I haven't even worried about the DNA because I'm happy to be a other, you know. But I will say this, if a black man say, are you black? I will say, yeah, I'm black. I mean, you can look at me and say, I'm not a black color person, but I believe that I'm suitable to be considered part of black, what is called a black community. But that's a good question, and I don't want to cut off the discussion. But as I say, I really enjoy listening to our folks have conversations together. I really do.
But
I'm gonna pull out of here.
I'm gonna say this before you leave. Let me say this before you leave. I don't know how you're talking to you too,
Mr. Jesus.
Yeah, oh, you're quite welcome, sir. I'm very pleased to meet to speak with you. I adopted that name under my grandfather in 1972. I was originally named after my father, who was Muhammad Ali's manager. I don't know if you know that name, but the point is that I adopted that name because I say I was born with the name Muhammad. And I got to a certain point in my life where I felt like, you know, if I can embrace and carry the name Muhammad, then I can certainly carry Christ's name too. Okay, I'll put it to you that way. So hopefully that makes
sense. Well, Christ, the word Christ is a title. Just like Christ is a title, Pharaoh is a title. And of course, it's all right for people to call themselves whatever they want to, but
I don't call myself Christ. I call myself by the name that he
yeah, I understand. Mm-hmm. But I was just saying what the word people have misunderstood with Christ. Now my birth certificate has Bianchi on it. And
I'm fluent in Spanish, and my great grandmother on my mother's side happened to be Mayan, and my great grandmother on my father's side, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's mother, his grandfather on his mother's side was pure blooded Cherokee. So that's the reason. I mean, I'm just speaking to you, you know, in terms of the Native American background stance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was just making reference that when you hear people talk, say Pharaoh, that was. You know, nobody back at that time called him Pharaoh. When you hear him say Caesar is title to less like King George, King Andrew, or Queen Elizabeth, or Queen Mary.
Even the name Muhammad is a title. It means praised and praiseworthy. It's not even really a name. That's, you know, it means praised and praiseworthy.
Well, I couldn't tell you about that.
I have to take your word for it. I'm sure. No, well, you can look into it. You know, just that name was given to the one to whom we.
Herod was a title too. It was many Herods. The word Jesus was a common name because of what it meant. It meant savior, just like William or Brown.
Let me go back to that. See, my understanding of the name Jesus. The name that Christ carried, he spoke Aramaic and Hebrew. It was Yeshua, or either referred to in Arabic as Isa, which means the swift of spirit, a person who can think fast. But Yeshua says helper of Jehovah.
It means Yeshua. It technically means savior. That's basically what my name is Bankole. In the Yoruba language, means builder. I mean, that's what it means. You know, a name reflects land, history, and culture. Those in the know, when they hear your name, they know where you're from or what culture that you spring from.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Washington, I'm getting ready to pull out.
Okay, Mr. Bianchi, well, thank you, as always.
We certainly appreciate your contribution, and I enjoyed our discussion.
I appreciate yours, too, sir. Thank you very much. See you all next week.
Okay, next week. We look forward to it. Okay, thank you, sir. And I guess I'm going to close out, Brother Mr. Jesus, but if you want to call me offline later, I just need a little bit of a break to catch up on a school assignment that I got to get in before too long tonight. It's going to take me about 30 minutes to wrap this up. And if you want to call and continue a private discussion with me, I certainly look forward to talking with you. But thank you for being on the program tonight. I think that was a very engaging conversation that you and Ms. Bianchi had. And you'll find, as you probably have heard it before, that he likes to actually get into the nitty-gritty and what we would call crack albums with people on different things. And I enjoy hearing him do that, so I hope that you've enjoyed, you know, the discourse. But if you want to talk later with me, please call me. I'll be available. I'm going to be up for another 2 or 3 hours.
Well, absolutely. Thank you, and appreciate the invitation. I just want to say, I'm not going to vacillate from the opinion I shared when the brother was on the phone. I enjoyed the conversation, and I was able to tell that he was the kind of person, like you say, you know, he gets into cracking atoms, and he's, he has this, you know, and I respect that. I do, sincerely do. Okay, my brother. With that, I say assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum salam. We want to say good night for all, to all that have shared this time with us this evening. You've been listening to Booker T. Washington Speaks, African American Family Room Forum. We hope that you will have a good next few days, as many of you will begin to get into the mood of the what is called the Christmas holiday spirit. We hope that those of you who are going to be traveling will be safe. The weather has not been very favorable for traveling in many places, so if you're going to travel, please check ahead to make sure it's going to be safe for you to get on the road or even to take an airplane trip. But may God bless all of you, and we thank you again. So good night, and have a nice few days of relaxation if you have some time off coming.